Good morning and welcome to The Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Sean Freeman.
Good morning, everybody.
And once again, we're the guys that work at the Binary Research Institute, where we investigate the possibility that ancient cultures might have known a few things that we haven't quite rediscovered yet. And we study here at the Binary Research Institute the idea that history or consciousness moves in vast cycles of time, something that the Indian culture called yugas, and many of us know them by the Greek names, the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. And the cycle is also associated with the precession of the equinox. Plato termed it the great year. And in that quest to try to figure out this cycle and how real it is and what evidence there is for it, we interview all sorts of interesting people, and we have one of those very interesting people on our show today, Dr. Carmen Bolter, and Sean will give us a little background on Carmen.
Absolutely. Dr. Carmen Bolter is a professor at the University of Calgary in the Graduate Division of Educational Research. Carmen's been to 52 different countries.
52.
In search of clues to lost matriarchal cultures. Her quest has brought her to Egypt 24 times, where she's done extensive research deciphering the symbols and structures of the ancient Egyptians. She's the author of Angels and Archetypes, an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness, and she has recently completed a groundbreaking documentary series called The Pyramid Code that gives insight into Egypt in a golden age in the distant past.
Ooh, I'm going to love this. Carmen, you on the phone?
I'm here. Hi, Walter. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
Great connection. 52 countries. Name them real quick.
Oh,
just kidding.
Egypt counts as one, and I've been there 24 times.
Oh, wow. I think you've traveled more than anybody I know.
That's... I've already taken 25 flights this year, and I'm not nearly done.
Oh, wow. Boy, yeah, it's only July.
I had one trip here to England and Ireland, saw the megalithic sites, and I'm still exhausted from it. So my hat's off to you, Carmen. And of course, I remember you, a few years back, you gave a fantastic presentation at CPAC, and I guess you're going to be at, would you say, Megalithomania next year?
Yep, in May. Yep, I've been invited.
Good, good. Well, we'll give Hugh Newman a good plug there. That is a terrific conference, and invite anybody that's listening to this show that's over in the UK to check out Megalithomania in May of 2011. So, Carmen, I guess I want to really hear about your recent Egypt trip and your thoughts on Nabta Playa, but, tell us, how did you get interested in this whole field in the first place?
Well, it was triggered by past life memories that started when I was a little girl, and I started reading about Egypt when I was 11, and there was also something wrong about what I was reading. I just had my stomach would turn, And so I went over there in 1977 for the first time, and it triggered all kinds of things inside me, and I read some more and kept going back and forth. And so mostly I think that I have been reacting to a cellular memory of other lifetimes in Egypt that perhaps didn't end so well, so my soul is eternally tied to figuring out what happened then and how it's of value to us now.
Wow. So it's really a passion, almost an obsession for you then to go there 24 times from Canada. That's quite a trip.
Yeah, and I lived over there for a little while. I had a place called the Hall of Records Retreat Center for 2.5 years. And I've been leading groups for 14 years and taking another group over. So we'll be in the Great Pyramid and between the paws of the Sphinx on 10-10-10. And the plan is 11-11-11 and 12-12-12.
Cool.
Good for you. That's fun. Okay, so to summarize sort of the traditional view of Egypt, it goes back roughly 4,500, maybe 4,700 years to the early pyramids, maybe a little over 5,000 years to the earliest structures, and that's about as old as the traditionalists put it. Where do you come out on sort of the dating to get us started here?
Well, for sure, I think that the last renovation of the Great Pyramid could have been 2450 BC, which is when they say it was built. I also have evidence that's shown in the Pyramid Code that there was likely other buildings on the platform where the pyramids are now. So they go back quite far. I mean, it's impossible to measure. But when you think about the Yuga cycles that you're so familiar with and the alignment to Leo, which is represented in the Sphinx, it has to be at least a precession and a half ago if you listen to John Anthony West, and that brings us all the way to 39,000 BC. I just cringe when people say 5,000-6,000 years. I feel it has to be far older because of the technology used. And the fact that we've become so disassociated through the patriarchal era in the Iron Age, the dark cycle, that we just wouldn't possibly have had the technology to do what they did. It doesn't add up. So I'm looking beyond 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. And you know, when if we were holding this conversation just 10 years ago, they'd laugh at us to say anything was more than 10,000 years old. But at least now, traditional school does recobnize that Göbekli Tepe, Turkey, and Nabta Playa will rival that age.
Well, what I noticed at CPAC is everybody agreed about pretty much everything except dating, and the degree to which they were tied to a university, the less likely they were to go farther back, and the people who are independent were willing to go further back. But also, over the years of going to CPAC 3 years in a row, I noticed that people were inching their way back farther and farther. And so it's true that we haven't been taught how to think of things as older. And it's almost inconceivable if you haven't practiced imagining it. And so it's something that we're opening up to because it makes sense and the rest of it doesn't add up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned some of the technologies. Give us, a little bit of color. What are some of the things that you've seen on your trips to Egypt that give, you know, raise your interest there?
Okay. Well, the most overwhelming and unlikely thing that I found is huge amounts of polished laser cut quartz. There's a huge, huge altar in Karnak that's about 3.5 feet high and 8 feet across. There is a laser-cut one that points to the four cardinal directions that has an absolutely perfect circular shape that's about 8 inches high, and the whole altar is, again, about 3 feet high by 10 feet across on either side. Beautiful, pure quartz at Abu Ghraib. There's 9 basins that are cut, like, with precision like you can't imagine, that are shallow bowls that actually have the shape in the shape of the bowl is actually like a satellite dish. The floor at Saqqara, there's hunks about 10 inches thick when you can see that the entire floor would have been covered in that. The polished floors of basalt in front of the Great Pyramid to the east in the temple there. A crystal floor in front of the Second Pyramid to the east. The temples are always to the east. Then we have the schist disc, which is like very, very thin and refined green hard stone that's in the shape of something that looks like a propeller. And Hakim, the indigenous wisdom keeper who's in the Pyramid Code, says that it was part of anti-gravity technology. There's frescoes in the crypts of Dendera where they're holding these large things that look like light bulbs. At Abydos, there is a lintel way up high, and a piece of stone was over the top of it, and underneath it you see shapes that look like a helicopter and an airplane.
Oh, yeah, I've seen pictures.
So, you know, there's so much that's there that's, again, right under our eyes, but we don't see it. But recently in the Assyrian, we were able to walk on the floor. This is a submerged temple, which indicates its huge antiquity. At Abydos, and the road has been closed pretty much for the last 13 years after the Luxor incident. You'd have to go in there with police escort. Now it's open, and miraculously, the floor is now no longer covered with water. Now it's known to be a water table, and a lot of these sites worked in conjunction with water. But prior to being able, you could only go on the stairs and you could only see two flowers of life. And I walked on the floor, and on one side there's 8 flowers of life, on the other side there's 10, which makes 18. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to Drunvala Melchizedek, he'll talk to you about the 18th breath, he can talk about the 18th dynasty. It's very curious, and we didn't have that information until just recently.
Hmm. These polished stones I've seen, they are amazing, and you mentioned laser cut. I guess we don't actually know how they were cut, but they're so smooth, or some of the shapes are so symmetrical or geometric that it's just assumed they must have had some sort of precision cutting capability. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but when you look at it and you hold up a chisel, I mean, there's just no way you could do it with a chisel. And up at Abu Roush, there is a concave-shaped stone that's smooth, almost at the shape of a windshield, if you will, but you can see the machine tool marks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they had to have had something. And when you look at the precision, you know, I've looked at sites all over the world, and almost nothing's as precise as what you see in Egypt. And Chris Dunn has one of these rulers that's absolutely precision flat, and he put it against the stone sarcophagi in the Serapeum at Saqqara, shone a light underneath, and there's no bumpy nothing. It's just absolutely precise. And so, yes, they had to have had something that was machine tooling of some description. They had to have.
Yeah. Yeah, Chris Dunn had him on the show once, and his work's rock solid. You can't find a lot of flaws in it.
Well, yeah, and he started us off. You know, he's made a big contribution to the field. And, you know, there's more of the sound and light technology and how it would have worked that's come out since. But he certainly brought us, I think, a lot of insight into what the pyramid could have been.
Yeah. Okay, and well, let's talk about that. First, maybe start with a layout, if you could. You mentioned in the pyramid code, which is, for our listeners, this is just a beautiful DVD set that Carmen produced. And it's 5 different shows, is that correct?
Yeah, it's 5 television hours.
5 television hours, yeah, and several discs. And you mentioned in there that... placement of the pyramids is very specific. Can you talk about that first?
Yeah, I actually started looking at Starry Night Pro based on your work, Walter, looking at how, like, as you had written in your book, The Lost Star, about the possibility that we would have been in some kind of a binary star system with Sirius. And so I went in and I put in Sirius and I put in... Orion and the Earth and various other things, and then chose the extragalactic grid and then ran it 50,000 years back and 50,000 years forward, and everything rotates around Sirius. And it's been said that one of the shafts inside the Great Pyramid always points to Sirius. And some people go, well, buh, how can that be? Well, it can only be if we are exactly in a binary relationship with it, and it seems that the ancients knew this. So... if you look at the layout, well, let's look at the stars first. If you put into Starry Night Orion, Sirius, the Pleiades, and the Milky Way, you come up with a configuration that just looks exactly like the placement of the Nile when it used to run in front of the Sphinx, and now the water table's coming up again. And then the Giza Plateau has Orion's belt, and then you see Orion would have been pointing his sword at the Pleiades, which is what you see in the sky, and that's represented by Abusir. And behind the Orion's belt is Sirius, which would be represented by Abu Roush. And again, if you rotate this 50,000 years back and 50,000 years forward, the most astonishing thing is that the whole sequence stays together, and that's what's represented in the sky-ground correlation. So now the Nile has migrated 8 miles to the east, but there's plenty of evidence, because you can see the old riverbed, that it used to run right in front of the pyramids. And we've replicated this in animations in the pyramid code.
Great. Well, I've got a copy of it here. I thank you for sending it to me, but I haven't actually seen the whole thing yet, and so I'm going to just enjoy doing that at home real soon. I wanted to tell our listeners that in addition to producing the pyramid code... Carmen also wrote Angels and Archetypes, an Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness. So how does that book, by the way, fit with your general work on the Pyramid Code?
Well, the thing that we don't usually hear about in Egypt is the fact that it was matriarchal. Now, 3113 BC coincides with the beginning of the Mayan calendar, but also the beginning of the dynasties, the first dynasty in Egypt, but it also represents a patriarchal era. And so if you look beyond that, further back in Egypt, you see all kinds of symbols of the sacred feminine. And that's largely misunderstood because we look at everything through our patriarchal lenses. And one of the things that's sure is that the balance between the masculine and the feminine was required, necessary for spiritual advancement. And so that meant that the masculine part of the female and the feminine part of the male had to be in balance somehow. And now we've, you know, the Bible demonizes the feminine, and there's, you know, lots of things that, you know, it's been a man's world for so long that it's really hard for us to see the symbols. But because my eye has been tuned to that, there's plenty of places in Egypt where you see the seated goddess and the populace coming to them. And even in Abydos, you see Seti the First, and it's said in Eric Neumann's book, The Great Mother, that he's sitting on the throne. But he's sitting on the lap of Isis, and Isis is sitting on the throne. Mm. And so the importance of the sacred feminine is really very prominent in ancient Egyptian art, but most of the time traditionalists are taking pictures of other things and not focusing on that. You know, but I've seen that in other places. In Sicily, there's a place where every single thing in the museum is feminine and women and all of that, and then there's one statue of a male, and they've got it on the front cover of the guidebook. And which is very misleading because you don't realize that it's a goddess-centered culture if you're looking at everything through patriarchal lenses.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting work that roughly prior to 3000 BC, it seems not just Egypt or Italy, as you say, but all throughout old Europe, it seemed to be more of a matriarchal culture and a much more peaceful culture in that we find very few weapons at that time. And it says only as we're slipping into the lower ages that, brute force seems to become popular and things get very goofed up.
Well, older is deeper. So and archaeology is a relatively new science and only started in around 1910. And so the first things that were found were the things on the surface. So as we go deeper, we find older things. Maria Gambutis was finding all kinds of goddess-centered cultures around and little dolls that, yes, they were found by the hundreds in stone urns.
Yeah, I love her work.
Yes.
Yeah. She passed away some years ago, I guess, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, then we're not going to get her on the radio show right away. So.
No, but she made her contribution.
She sure did, yeah. Okay. Moving on then. So the pyramids are in a sort of a stellar pattern, as you say, and there's evidence of higher technology. So you sound like you're pretty sold then on this concept of the yugas, that's therefore older is not only deeper, but older and deeper is also often wiser.
Yes, I would agree 100%.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Yeah, it's very cool.
That's such a major paradigm shift from what we're taught in the schools and everything. And I'm glad you're doing the amount of work you're doing with that mindset. That is
well, and people know that the school system dumbs us down and it's fact-driven and, you know, teacher-centered teaching instead of learner-centered learning. There's so much wrong with what's going on the planet right now. And it has to do with the big imbalance between the masculine and the feminine. We need to be whole, and we need to come back to values that were exemplified easily in ancient Egypt.
I hear you. Yeah, it has to do with that. And just the fact, you know, when there's a basic truth that we kind of know deep down in our bones, subconsciously, but if it's not conscious, then it seems, and we're teaching something different, then it seems there's almost an angst or a, a troubling pattern in the world.
Well, you know, one of the purposes of doing the Pyramid Code was to trigger high-level initiate cellular memory. And I have gotten thousands of letters from individuals who watch the Pyramid Code and just get so excited because they can feel in their bones that it's right. And it's unmistakable when you have a physical reaction to something that you see that you've never heard before, but you know it.
Yeah. Well, hold that thought, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're talking with Carmen Bolter, who is the author of The Pyramid Code. And Carmen, I guess you mentioned in that there's some evidence of wireless power system. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The ancients seem to have had the capability of the transmutation of the atom. And again, a lot of what we're seeing in Egypt now, we're starting to be able to decipher in terms of quantum mechanics and things that we're just coming into knowing. And that's why we've thought that they, you know, didn't really know much and they were infantile and misguided. But there's something about the way they worked with sound and light and water. And even if you look at the old language, a priest and a priestess, they were the ones who worked with water. And that was the symbolism that went with it. And so, coming back to Chris Dunn's work, the idea is that the water underneath the Giza Plateau, the Nile would run beside it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a series of zigzag passageways, which actually are honeycomb, which is a really interesting shape when you think about quantum physics. And the zigzag pattern and the crystalline matrix of granite would build a charge in the water as it moved around the corners. And Emoto does this kind of work as well, and Dan Winter. And then the water would be forced up into the pyramid, but eventually there's capacitors and magnetrons inside of microwaves, and the water molecule was being blasted apart, and they were harnessing the hydrogen, so it was a passive power that didn't pollute and was free. And so Nikola Tesla understood this, and if you look at the Tesla Tower that was built on Long Island in the early 1900s, they have descending passageways that goes to a limestone aquifer that's exactly the same construction as over the Giza Plateau. And he figured out how to give free energy, and J.P. Morgan came along and said, no, we are charging money for this. And they drove him into obscurity. So the wireless technology was available to us, and I think that Tesla was likely remembering it from those times. And we still have that ability. And it's, again, been driven into obscurity. The powers that be want to make money off utilities, and they've made plenty of money off utilities. If you think you got all the money back from taxes and utilities that you and your family has ever spent, you'd be sitting on a lot of money. So we lost that technology based on the fact that it wasn't supposed to be free.
Well, they were certainly doing some amazing things. It just the massive amount of stone that was moved to build these structures, and the complexity of some of the structures, it's just unimaginable that you do it all with slave labor. So,
yeah, it doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah, it really doesn't. I'm sure you see that or feel that in your bones after 24 visits there.
Well, it's not just that. Like I look at rail cars from light rapid transit systems in cities, and one of those weighs 9 tons. And it would be like, you know, you, me, Sean, and 5 of our friends trying to get a car up on the roof every minute, 24/7, for 20 years, for the number of rocks that there were. But that's 9 tons, and some of the stones are as much as 200 tons.
Wow.
And so, you know, pulling them with a little, you know, tutu and ropes, I mean, where are you going to stand? Like, after we put 9 cars on my roof, where are you going to stand to put the rest of them up there? And so the idea of ramps and all of that, it just doesn't add up because the ramps would take up too much space. They would have to be built with rock. And when you get to the top, again, you know, there's no place to maneuver. So it's just not the way it was done.
I like the phrase you used earlier, the transmutation of atoms.
Yeah, well, this comes back to the siddhis, S-I-D-H-I, that are very well discussed in the Vedic tradition, which is where the yuga cycles come from. And basically, they're the abilities. And so there's 6 primary ones, telepathy, manifestation, levitation, which is anti-gravity, bilocation, teleportation, and alchemy. And so from my past life memories, it's definitely my conviction that the high-level initiates were able to do this. But when you think about the process of blowing the hydrogen and the oxygen molecule apart in the pyramid, our bodies are 70% water. So to be able to withstand that charge, the transmutation of the atom could actually occur within our physical beings.
Hmm.
And that's what contributes to these abilities. Now, that's really far out.
Yeah,
if
I like
you're
it.
Looking, if you're looking, pardon me?
I like that, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's far out if you're looking at things from the perspective of our dumbed-down world now. But when you think about all of the fantasy shows that are showing people like heroes, you know, the ability to fly and all that kind of thing, it appeals to our unconscious. And I think that we all know that somewhere inside we have those, had those abilities, but we're still working with the same DNA as they had in ancient Egypt. So, you know, if the conditions were right, if the energy was high, if we were trained and we were in the right frame of mind, it's possible that we can do all that.
Hmm.
I wouldn't doubt it, yeah. In fact, I just gave a talk on that topic at Boys Youth Camp, SRF Boys Youth Camp in the mountains, talking about some of the higher yugas and the great mythology about the heroes and the wonderful things they could do, and just trying to inspire the boys that we really don't know what we're capable of in the higher ages.
That's right.
Okay, so we're of a united opinion there that these things weren't put together with just all slave labor. And not only would it be difficult, but just the time itself makes it almost impossible to imagine.
Well, 2.3 million stones with that precision, you got to be really moving to get them all up there.
This is the Great Pyramid.
The Great Pyramid.
Has 2.3 million.
And then look how many pyramids there are. There's 67 in total in Egypt.
Wow.
22 in the Band of Peace. Yeah,
that's a lot of... So 2.3 in the time of just Khufu, who's the assumed builder of that, of the Great Pyramid, using just the daylight hours, because we don't know that... that they had light, I'm sure they had some kind, but that's where you get this this division that, you know, just a couple minutes per stone, which just seems totally mind-boggling.
Well, and the only evidence that they have a statue that's literally 2 inches high that they found 15 miles away, and they go, see, it proves it. Well, you know, we've got to be careful here. What is it proving?
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm. Very little. We're talking with Carmen Bolter. You're listening to The Cosmic Influence, and we'll be right back. Carmen, you've seen a lot of the hieroglyphs and Egyptian symbols firsthand, and I know that you've studied this subject. Tell me a little bit about what you feel the Egyptians are saying. Also, I've always been curious, do you... get the feeling that there's they're saying things differently in the very early dynasties versus some of the latter dynasties.
Okay, thanks. Well, I tried to learn hieroglyphic the way it's taught, and one of the things that I think is just evidence of us is there's 26 letters in the alphabet, and there's 4,000 hieroglyphic symbols. And so we say, this is an A, this is a B. Well, the Egyptians weren't waiting for English to come along to make things literal. Now, the other thing is that hieroglyphic is much more similar to Chinese and pictograms than it is to the linguistic language that works with our alphabet, which we'll find in Latin and other languages like that. But they're also vibrational symbols that are multi-level, multi-dimensional, and they are light technology. Now, I come upon this from, you know, visions I've had, and whenever I spent time inside the body of the Sphinx, which is very rare indeed, I wouldn't sleep for 72 hours, like a clock. But yeah. That also parallels Tibetan things. They've done all kinds of rituals where for 72 hours you go into the underworld to process information from other dimensions. And so I would be awake, and I would be downloading, literally, these light codes that looked like hieroglyphic, but they were three-dimensional, more than three-dimensional, but you could look around the corners, and they were literally vibrating out of light. And, you know, there's more to it, but I knew that there was that there were layers of meaning. Now, the other thing is when you look at the hieroglyphics, sometimes you'll see the birds pointing from right to left, facing in, and sometimes you'll see them pointing from left to right. And often you'll see mirror images of the same hieroglyphic pattern. And so, and then there's all these doorways between doorways, so up to seven of them. And these were dimensional portals that they were allowed, that the initiates would actually go through. And so when you think about the concept of a stereogram, which are those posters that kind of look like nothing until you relax your vision and then you can see in 3D, it's like the hieroglyphic messages were actually speaking about other dimensional frequencies. Now, there was they used to also, they tracked the stars, but I think they were able to do out-of-body experiences and go to the stars, and when they came back, then they had to, the trick, it's easy to leave, the trick is to return. But so all of these symbols are encoded, and they're much more profound than we've ever given credence to. And Laird Scranton, who's talked at CPAC, has helped us a lot with that. And he went straight to the Dogon priests that he believes are the descendants of the ancient Egyptians. And they're still using similar symbols and similar words.
So then you see the hieroglyphs as much more than letters or simple writing, but actually communicating information on a subtle level, I guess.
Sure. And then later, it became more of a simple script. And so there's many, many different styles of hieroglyphic. I mean, the symbols perhaps are represented, but sometimes they're dug in, innies, and sometimes they're embossed, outies. And at different times, like one thing that I like to think about when I go to Egypt with a group is, okay, what is young, what's medium, what's old, right? And the smallest stones are the youngest and the biggest stones are the oldest. But also, the most sophisticated of the hieroglyphic work is older. And so then you can see how it became sloppier. And so in the temples at Abu Simbel, for example, I mean, it's just nothing compared to temples that were built a lot earlier. And so, yeah, it's symbols, and it evolved devolved, if you will, over time, to where you see papyrus that's just written with a pen, like a ink, very quickly, which is different.
So, and this is obvious to you as you look at the many different sites that the latter kingdoms, latter dynasties are. You used the word sloppy.
Yep, I did use that word. And the other, and what they try to do with traditional Egyptology is say Ramses, and they're talking about the 22nd dynasty, and forgetting about everything that came before it, but everything that came before the dynastic period. And so, yes, the most sophisticated material is the oldest.
I love the reinforcement. Thank you. I've often thought about the three-dimensional structure of hieroglyphs, as well as the cuneiform tablets are the same way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems just so deliberate that there's got to be something else there, you know. Just as sort of Braille can appeal to more than vision, you know, people are feeling it. If text is done in a three-dimensional pattern, you could run water over it and get a certain vibration. I'm just intuiting that it has a much deeper purpose than what we think of as simple writing, which is the way it's interpreted right now.
And you're saying a lot there, too, because there's a temple in the Valley of the Kings that was built by Ramses, and everything is dug in. And if you ran the water over it, it would all just accumulate. But the embossed ones would be the ones that... And there's lots of that where they would run water over things. And so, again, if the priest is the one who works with water, there's definitely something to that. It's an energetic...
Yeah, I'd like to, you know, hear Emoto's comments on that someday, in that he's worked so much with water. Okay, so once again, we're talking with Carmen Bolter. Carmen is the producer of the Pyramid Code, which I'm reading the back here. It's 222 minutes runtime. And this is from one trip to Egypt or several trips to Egypt, Carmen?
Oh. Well, I took crews over 4 or 5 times, and we had to do aerial footage, and the order got signed by the Minister of Defense. No, it's a lot of research and a lot of time.
Great. And the episodes are The Band of Peace, High Level Technology, Sacred Cosmology, The Empowered Human, and A New Chronology. And if people want this, what do they go to your website or can get it on Amazon or where?
Amazon.com, and it got to number 2 on the bestsellers list in its category.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, great. And do you have a website also?
Yeah, pyramidcode.com.
Great.
There's lots of archived interviews and things.
Great. Okay, we'll take a quick break here. You're listening to The Cosmic Influence, and we'll be right back. Okay, Carmen, before we get off the subject of Egypt, you mentioned that you went to Nabta Playa, which is in southern Egypt. Can you tell us a little bit about that site?
Yeah, what you find is both microlithic and megalithic stones that are aligned to the solstices and equinoxes, to Orion, Sirius, and the Pleiades, and Ursa Minor. And these are all the key marker points to how our position in the galaxy, our position in the universe, are measured. And so when you think about the dating of it, I mean, to me, if there was a world flood and our technology went down and we lost all our stuff, let's imagine right now, if something happened and we lost the grid and we had no electricity, in the winter in Canada, you would have to go walk around and find somewhere else to be, but we would start again. If we had the mentality of the ancient Egyptians, we would start with the marker stones, because the flooding of the Nile, our very survival, when to plant and all of that is connected to these cycles of time, the smaller cycles of time as well as the larger cycles of time. And so what Nabta Playa is several stone calendars and external marking points, but you see it repeated over and over again, and it's the same planetary systems that are and star systems that are represented on the plateau with these huge pyramids. So it's very, very curious indeed. And the carbon-14 dating, which is notoriously making things younger, the last thing that they dated was something like 8,000 years ago. And so it stands to reason that it could go all the way back to the other flood. And there's other stone circles at Gilf Kebir, which is 550 kilometers to the west. And there's more stone circles throughout the African continent, all the way down and south. And so it's very curious indeed. And the focus on alignment seems to fit with matriarchal cultures as well. So it makes sense, and it's really interesting.
Hmm. So Nabta Playa, then, is something that the traditional Egyptologists would concur is much older than the Giza Plateau structures.
Well, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, personally, I don't think so. I mean, everybody's got their own idea about dating.
Okay.
And I don't think that, you know, carbon-14 is notoriously poor the farther back you go. But they will say that the pastoralists that came around with their cattle and they were migrating would pass by this area when there was water. But, you know, when you see at Gilf Kebir in the Cave of the Swimmers, you know, you see people swimming. And so that's where The English Patient was filmed. So if there, and Gilf Kebir, Gilf is plateau, and Kebir means big in Arabic. And so the plateau itself is a high plateau that's the size of Switzerland. And so let's say there was a world flood and a lot of people perished and a couple of people swam to safety. You climb up on that plateau, there's water all around, start marking the stars and paint people swimming on the ceiling. It kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
I don't know. It's just it just continually reminds me how little we really know about it. Was it just your recent trip that you also made it down to the tip of Africa, South Africa, and looked at the ruins of Michael Tellinger?
Yeah, Michael heard me talking about the Pyramid Code on Coast to Coast, and then he contacted me and invited me to come and evaluate the stone ruins down there, and with the idea of possibly making another documentary series. So I went down and shot a trailer in May, still doing the editing on that, And so that's really curious, too. So there's Adam's calendar, which, again, seems to be marking solstices and equinoxes. And then there's all these curious stone circles, like lots of them, that extend for lots of miles, like hundreds of miles.
Yeah, I saw the aerial photos. I couldn't believe how many.
And they're also connected to agricultural terraces. And then there's a ground covering over the top. So it could be that prior to the flood, this stuff was there, and then it covered up. Like, it's very difficult to get science on it, and I think Michael's operating from his hunches, and I think we all hope that it could be the lost city of Enki and the Anunnaki and be as old as 200,000 years old. But it's almost impossible to determine that in a scientific way. One of the curious things is that the stones ring like bells, and they have a high silica content, so silica iron, and silica is crystal, and then dolerite, and they're covered with a patina, which takes a really long time to grow. So this is part of, you know, how Michael's talking about them being far, far older. Yet these stones are small, and they don't fit together like in Egypt, but they are generally aligned to the 31-degree east longitude. So, I mean, the whole thing makes everybody scratch their head, but you know there's something to it because there's so many of them. And they're round, so they could be like kivas in America. And the other thing, though, that a friend of mine was reading John Burke at the same time as she was reading Michael Tellinger, and she said, well, why wouldn't it be to fortify seeds? Now, you've interviewed John Burke, I'm sure, Walter, and he certainly has been at CPAC, so he's talking about an agricultural culture being able to make more food for its people through charging of seeds. And so all of these stone circles, aside from the calendar itself, like the stone circles seem to be energetic structures that have roadways that connect them, and they have no doors. So they can't be dwellings, and the traditionalists down in South Africa say that they're dwellings. But that doesn't make sense. And then they say they're cattle kraals, corral, but that's Afrikaans. Why would you bring your cattle to the very top of the mountain without it? There's no door to the thing, and the ground's not level. So they see, and if they ring like bells, like I've actually got footage, and if you take the picture off and just listen to it, and it's actually Michael holding one of these stones and then striking it with another stone. And it sounds like a church bell. Hmm. So we've got to wonder what's going on energetically, why they were there, why there's so many, why there's agricultural terraces close to them,
right,
and why it's aligned to Great Zimbabwe and to Giza and to Naupto Playa, roughly.
Yeah, it's very curious. I heard
it?
Michael's talk at Megalithomania and saw a lot of pictures, but I've never been there to South Africa. But I do concur that the fact that these things don't have openings seems unlikely that they'd be used for animal, corrals, coops, whatever they call them.
Well, and the cows could just knock them down, too. Like, they're smaller structures. Yeah, it's very, very interesting.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, Carmen, we're just about the end of the show here. So I wanted to thank you for being on and also remind people about your DVD here, The Pyramid Code, and encourage people to go to either your website, The Pyramid Code, or go to Amazon and pick up a copy, because we just barely scratched the surface, and there's a lot more here, including a lot of nice pictures and video.
It's Pyramid Code, the website.
Oh, just
not
Pyramid.
Not the.
Okay, just Pyramid Code. Great. Yeah. Thanks again for being on, Carmen. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Walter and Sean. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I love talking to Carmen, not only because she's a great scientist that's done so much traveling and so much first-person investigation into these ancient sites, but because she's totally adopted the Yuga cycle as a matrix, a way to look at ancient cultures, and that pleases me greatly because that's been our main thrust of our work here at the Binary Research Institute.
And don't forget to check out Walter's book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, for more on some of the topics discussed today, such as the mystery of ancient texts and hieroglyphics, the Yugas, and why the Egyptians may have worshipped Sirius.
So, anyway, thanks for listening to the show, Cosmic Influence. And in the meantime, bring on the higher ages.